Rack and Fin Radio with Tom P on 97.3 ESPN.
So what's up with the Stripers? 2026, we shall see. Hey, you're inside Rack and Fin Radio with me, Tom P. We've got September 20th and 21st. You're tuned in 7 to 8 a.m. to 50,000 mega far-reaching watts of the Rack and Fin Radio message, 97.3 ESPN FM, streaming live, 97.3ESPN.com. Download the 97.3 app or go to Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or other platforms to get the Rack and Fin Radio message via podcast. It's usually posted Saturday afternoon or sometime Sunday. Was at the meeting Tuesday night over there in Manahawk and at the Stafford Fire Company. I'd say there were 100 seats out, some standing room. I'd say 110, 120 people maybe. Tough questions, comments, handled it well. Saw a bunch of familiar faces there. One in particular sitting towards the front, always engaged, always active, Jim Hutchison Jr., managing editor, New Jersey Delaware Bay edition of the Fisherman Magazine. He is opening up the show with us to tell about the meeting so far. My take on it is status quo. There are other options. Hutch, thanks for joining us. Very short notice, but I had to open the show with you, man. What did you think?
I appreciate it. No, I think you're spot on. I thought it was overall respectful. It was a good meeting. I thought it was sparsely attended. Usually a meeting like this will get a couple hundred people in
there. That's what I was surprised about. Yeah, but still, over 100 is, you know, again, it was a fairly good number. Go ahead.
Well, folks fed back to me, and they were just, I think a lot of people feel frustrated and defeated at this point. You know, so you had one segment of the audience who kind of felt like, you know, I can't do anything about it. I'm tired of this. You know, you go to these meetings, I get angry. And I think there was another segment of the community that really wants to see the 12% reduction, and they felt that they were going to be – this is some feedback I'm getting.
Yeah.
That they felt that they were going to be outspoken, so they didn't want to turn out either. But you're right. The numbers that I wrote down is pretty much 10 to 1 or more of folks interested in seeing status quo, meaning leave the 28 to 31-inch slot limit as it is. And no closure in 2026. So that was my flavor from New Jersey.
Jim, the closures, I'm not going to give the guy's name out, but he made a very well, says case very well, charter captain up in the Raritan Bay area. Good guy. But he says, in a nutshell, basically, paraphrasing a little bit, with these closures, I'm losing 36% of my business. Remember him?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, he's a sharp guy.
What an impact! And he said, now, "How about you and your paycheck? 36% is like how would?" And he laid it out in every man's terms. And he said, and then Nick Cicero from Folsom, there's a national sales guy, Tsunami, all that stuff. When he brought up about the circle hooks and this, that proven there was no impact whatsoever. The economic impact though on retailers who were stuck with all this. Jim, it was. I didn't want to be the person in front, man. She did a great job, though.
Emily was off. You brought up 2 points. One, you mentioned the charter captain up on the Raritan. Now, I know him very well. He's always gotten, and many of the Raritan Bay captains get a lot of their spring business, especially in fall. But they're folks from Pennsylvania coming down.
Yep.
And if you think about that, a lot of folks will come down from Pennsylvania. They can't fish every day during the week. They come down on weekend, and they expect to bring back something for the family. So when it went to in New Jersey, what was it, 28 to 37, 28
right.
to 38, whatever
right.
that original slot was, he and others lost a lot of business.
Yep.
Then when it got constricted to 28 to 31 inches, lost a lot more business. And again, it was primarily a Pennsylvania audience. So if you imagine, for example, a closure of striped bass harvest as of Black Friday 2026, which is the numbers that I add up,
right.
how many folks from Pennsylvania aren't going to come down and fish? So he was spot on. Which is kind of me triggering this fact that if you're from Pennsylvania and listening to this and you're coming down to the shore for the weekend, you have a meeting in Bristol, Pennsylvania on Wednesday, September 24th. So Pennsylvania has a key vote at the ASMSC,
right.
and a lot of Pennsylvania anglers don't realize that. So I'll be up in Bristol, Pennsylvania, Wednesday, September 24th, and I would encourage other anglers who are striper fishermen from Pennsylvania who want to weigh in. Go to this meeting because these meetings really are important.
Well, Jim, one of the things that and several people raise this point and think, okay, so we do this and we do this and we do this and you decide we adopt what you want to do, whatever the best option would be, for example, to get it to that arbitrarily 2029, you know, reduction 12, to get it to whatever number they're looking at.
Right.
And then, oh, man, we're almost there, but we're not even close to that number. Then what happens? Then what kind of restrictions are you going to put on? You know what I mean?
Well, go back to the 28 to 31, when that slot limit was implemented a few years back, that wasn't because of the issue we're looking at now. Mm-hmm. My understanding is the 28 to 31 inch slot limit was done as an emergency to protect the 2015 year class, because the assumption was that we stopped harvesting these bigger fish over 32 inches. They're the breeders. They're the best. And if we let, you know, this smaller slot limit harvest go into play, then we're going to see a better recruitment year. And a lot of us said, well, what happens if we don't? We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Well, here we are crossing that bridge.
Kicking the can.
We're left with 28 to 31 inches, and there's no other place to go to reduce our amount of mortality. So, you know, this folks, I thought the folks that were there that laid out the argument and debate for status quo made a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a benchmark stock assessment on this fishery coming up in 2027. We were talking about the recreational data collection, which is under review, and it's under a new pilot project that gets launched next year. So the folks that said status quo in that room for a majority made a lot of sense. That says now, you know, now is not the time.
Right.
Can't do it.
And like, and again, the over tenor was, where do we go? I mean, what's left? Jim, there were a couple of whispers in the back. Just, you know, I'm in the last seat in the last row, closest to the door. But they brought up, and these guys weren't just rowdies. These guys were like whispering, and the M word came up a couple of times. What are they going to? You think they're going to bring up possibility of a moratorium? And there were two or three talking. They calmed down, but that was even a matter of the chatter in the back. You know, off the main screen.
It's hard to believe that we'd be talking about the dreaded M word, moratorium, at a time where our stock today, the spawning stock biomass of striper today, is exactly the same as it was in 1995 when we declared striped bass rebuilt and celebrated.
Yeah.
So we're growing. The stock right now is growing. It's not growing fast enough, according to the data, to hit the magic mark by 2029. I will say this, though. If the data is right about recruitment, about baby stripers on the Chesapeake, if that data is right, we are in for some lean years. But those are two separate issues.
Mm-hmm.
Spawning stock biomass rebuild by 2029 is one issue. The problem in the Chesapeake is a separate issue. And the two of them, as a lot of folks said on Tuesday night, really don't kind of come together, because we could have all the spawning stock biomass in the world, but if there's a problem with the Chesapeake, that's something different. So,
exactly right. You know, thanks for coming on very short notice. You have safe travels out to PA, okay?
I'm looking forward to it. I hope to see a bunch of friends out there in Bristol, Pennsylvania next Wednesday.
So. Hey, Jimmy, thanks for coming on again. Listen, this is beyond short notice. Hutch is, well, yeah, sure. Hutch is always ready. Always ready. Jim, good to see you again, man.
You too, Tom.
Take care, brother. Yeah, it was interesting. Again, I thought more. As with Hutch, I figured a couple of hundred, but over 100 was pretty good. And some great points were raised. And the woman who ran it, she was a messenger. She did a very good job. Okay, man, coming up. Hey. Next week, man, rabbits and squirrels. Season opens. Be right back. Rack and Fin Radio.
Hi, this is Billy Schwein. Saturday morning in the locker room with Billy Schwein. Join me and Nikki Earnshaw as we recap the week in Philly sports. The Phillies are in Arizona for 3 games against the Diamondbacks. And we will go on the mound with former Phillies pitcher Tommy Green, brought to you by Blitz's Market of Ocean City. The Birds welcome the Rams to the Link on Sunday, and we will preview the game. Plus, we get the high school athletes in the spotlight with Fran McLaughlin, brought to you by the Philly Pretzel Factory of Egg Harbor Township. It's the locker room with Billy Schwein, Saturday morning from 10 a.m. to noon on 97.3 ESPN.
Rack and Fin Radio with Tom P. on 97.3 ESPN.
Yeah, back inside Rack and Fin Radio with me, Tom P. Week of September 20th and 21st. Hey, you're tuned in 7 to 8 a.m. on 50,000 far-reaching megawatts of the Rack and Fin Radio Show, 97.3 ESPN FM. Streaming live, 97.3ESPN.com. Download the 97.3 app or go to Apple, Spotify, YouTube, whatever, or other platforms, get the Rack and Fin radio message. Hey, man, next week is going to be, it's an early Happy New Year right here in the Rack and Fin Radio universe, the parallel universe where the season opens or reopens. Indeed, close for a New Year's celebration. You want to get on a little early, September 27th. Opening of the gray squirrel, cottontail rabbit, and they also say hare, there's some around, I don't know, season. I live for squirrels. I live for bunnies. When I made this early open on a squirrel back in the 80s, I said, this is great. Made it with rabbits. This is great. Join us online right now. Give us an update. See what's happening. Perspectives is Peter Stark. He is a DEP Fish and Wildlife fur bear and small game mammal biologist. Give us a lowdown on the squirrels and the bunnies stay white. Peter, how you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
You are always welcome. Am I too excited or what? Bunny time, squirrel time. This is crazy. Pete, squirrels everywhere. Would you agree probably one of the most underutilized resources on the hunting end in the state?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're everywhere, right? Mm. And seasons long, bag limits are generous. So, yeah, definitely encourage people to get out there.
And the early season, it's prime. Here's the thing, whether a youngster, middle age, whatever, starting out or an expert, it's still a great time. The cover's going to be still a little heavy up there. Arboreal cover's going to be a little heavy, thins out a little bit. And people think, they equate squirrel hunting when you're in a park and you see a squirrel. You know, you're on a bench, whatever. No, man. These things in the wild, they'll make you pull your hair out. They're extremely fast through the treetops. And let me tell you something. You try to hit a squirrel that's tear-assing along the ground, man, that makes that rabbit target in a sporting clays course look like as anchors on its legs. Those things are mad fast as all get out.
They really are. They're such a great way for people to get into hunting, mm-hmm. if they're new to the sport, or it's just you never done it before. Definitely a lot of fun being out in the woods,
and they're great on the tail. But Pete, to the gray squirrel resource, again, underutilized, whatever, but population's pretty stable. One question, always: how many times do they mate a year? I mean, how many litters will they have?
Sure. So they have an average of 2 litters a year.
Okay.
Some of that is food dependent. So if they have a bad year of acorns, they may not produce those 2 litters. They may only produce 1 or none. Mm-hmm. But generally, 2 litters a year with 2 to 4 young per litter.
Okay, so they'll keep the population going. Listen, the daily limit is 5. And I see some guys, why not make it 10? Because hardly anyone's out there. Although, Stark, I'm noticing over the past 5-6 years especially, not a lot, but more people, taking advantage of the squirrel in the early squirrel season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a, like I said, great opportunity to get out there. Definitely encourage people to take advantage if they never have before.
Predation on gray squirrels. I know they fight to the death. I talked to some guys from the Falcon Association with the red tail hawks all scarred up. Mm-hmm. That's a battling with a gray squirrel. But again, the young, early, again, foxes, raccoons, stuff like that.
Yeah, pretty much just like a rabbit. Anything you can think of is going to try to get a gray squirrel if it can. Certainly. Population-wise, biggest causes of mortality, aside from natural predation, would be, human-derived causes of mortality, like, getting hit by a car, mm-hmm. or, getting caught by a animal control agent somewhere. Usually those things are not enough to really cause any sort of harm to the population.
One thing, Pete, that I find, again, the more I drive around, and I'm very fortunate, I get to travel the state fairly often, and development. I mean, prime oak woods, shagbark, hickory, all homes now are pad sites. It's scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely can be a concern. Although, the gray squirrel, the wonderful thing about it is it's such an adaptable animal. So,
I'll tell you, if it can
survive in Central Park, yeah. It probably can survive.
Hey, Stark, I swear those things can count. I mean, especially if they've been in an area that gets a fair amount of hunting pressure. And sometimes they won't come out. You have maybe, hunting hours or what? It's a half hour after sunset. 1 minute before, half hour after sunset, then they'll come out of the trees, run down, grab some nuts, and run back up the tree. I said, damn, man.
Yep.
But one thing I'm noticing, coming further and further and further south, the melanistic phase. Listen, that means, you ever see a black gray squirrel? I saw my first one in Michigan back in the 80s. What the hell is that? And I notice them up in Sussex County, where the water gap, when they're moving. And now I'm seeing them in Central Jersey here and there. Is that will they eventually all turn black? What's the deal with that? It's a recessive gene, is it not?
It is a recessive gene. Yeah, there's actually a number of different color phases that the gray squirrel can have. I mean, the typical gray and then the melanistic would be the most common.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's, when you find melanistic squirrels, they tend to generally be in the same spot all the time because that localized population will just keep spreading that recessive gene around.
So,
it's definitely a cool thing to see. Typically, I believe they're associated more with the northern part of the state. But, yeah, definitely. I mean, if people are seeing them, it's a great, great thing to witness and have an opportunity.
They are unusual. Joe Satellite is Peter Stark. He's fur bear and small game mammal biologist of DEP's Fish and Wildlife. Topic is a gray squirrel. Season is going to run through November 7th and again January 3rd to February 21st. Even have a muzzle-loading rifle season here. And check out in the digest the zones where you can shoot with a muzzle. Daily bag limit is 5. There is no season limit. Hey, Pete, you know what I think? I had a chance to hunt a guy. It was a rat terrier or something. Squirrel dog. It's like being an old-time Ocala, Florida or something like that. They would have those fox squirrels. They're the size of armadillos, man. Look out. But it's really amazing to see these little things. They get that and the whole thing is the dog runs around a tree barking its head off, and the squirrel runs, bang, done.
Yeah.
That's really a lot of fun. Okay, let's get to the cottontails. Everything wants to eat a rabbit, and they give up the ghost easily. I've seen, the hawks, especially the foxes. Rabbits, I'd say it's my fisheries background, spawn. They'll have how many litters a year in prime weather, prime conditions? 2, 3, what? You always hear breed like rabbits.
Right, and they really do. So anywhere from 3 to 7 litters a year and an average of around four young per litter. So to sort of equate that is, the average breeding female in a population can produce anywhere from 20 to 30 young per year.
Mm-hmm.
So, the general reproductive strategy on the rabbit is to put out as many offspring as possible.
Right.
Because, like you said, everything wants to eat them.
Survival rate, say a litter of 10, I guess you can't really equate it with anything, but 1 or 2 survive. That's a banner litter then, you think? With everything trying to get to them?
Yeah, I would say probably so. So average lifespan of the cottontail rabbit is around 1 to 2 years. But most rabbits end up dying in their first year. And some studies have shown that approximately 80 to 85% of the overall population in any given year is mostly comprised of juvenile rabbits.
Okay. Now, this is the season coincides with that of the squirrel, but the daily limit is 4, and boy, do they make good eating. I put them right up there. I'm a squirrel guy myself. I put them right up there with the squirrel. So the hunting impact then really doesn't, the hunting activity really doesn't impact them that much then, correct, in the big picture?
That's correct. Yeah. Again, just like a squirrel, your main causes of mortality are not going to be from hunting. It's going to be that natural predation, rabbits getting hit by cars or what have you. But hunting as a whole, not going to be a problem for the population.
Well, Pete, one other question. Was there a rabbit disease that was out in other states that were about getting New Jersey? You know anything about that?
Sure. I'm assuming probably you're referring to rabbit hemorrhagic disease.
Yeah, that's the one. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So there was one documented case in New Jersey in 2022. That was a domestic rabbit in Cape May County. So never been found in the wild. It is a very contagious virus, but thankfully it's never been detected in a wild rabbit here. It is a problem in other areas of the country, particularly out west, but doesn't seem like it's going to be a factor for us.
Oof, okay, now, again, except for habitat, destruction, loss of habitat, whatever you want, it's wide open. It's a great time to hunt bunnies. I'll tell you one thing. This time of the year, they're out early. They are out early, right? Basically, as soon as the first light, then poof, they scoot in, and then they come out again later in the afternoon. In the winter, it's reversed, and we hunt them in December, January, February. They're not out there first. I mean, they're huddled down. I mean, they're staying as warm as they can. And they'll sneak out for a little bit to chow. And that's when, that's the optimum time to hunt them. Listen, there's a lot of fun, small game rocks. We're going to be stocking the pheasants of it. Squirrel and bunny, early season opportunity to get out in the woods, get out in the fields and enjoy. And the culinary delights at the end of a hunt is just absolutely it's a great, great endeavor. And Pete, when they opened the season, or like I said, with the squirrels back in the 80s, then with the rabbits, it was a 10, 12 year, whatever it was. Really, really opened up opportunities. Like I said, seeing slowly but surely more and more people partaking of the opportunity.
Yeah, it's a great, great thing to do. Just, New Jersey is such a wonderful state because there's so many different ways that you can get out and pursue so many different kinds of animals. So definitely encourage people to get out there.
Okay, Peter Stark, thanks for joining us on Rockin' Listeners. Next week, Saturday, September 27th, rabbit and squirrel season. Oh, Peter Stark, thanks for joining us. You are so cool, man. Hope to see you in the woods or fields one of these days.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate you having me on.
Later, Gator. Squirrels and bunnies. Doesn't get better than that. Be right back. Rack and Fin Radio.
Unsportsmanlike with Evan Cohen, Chris Canty, and Michelle Small.
Jalen Hurts this season has a better QBR on third downs versus the blitz when pressured in the red zone and a better QBR in the fourth quarter. To me, those are all elements of quarterback play. And Jalen Hurts is better than Matt Stafford in all of them. The only thing that people look at is Jalen Hurts not having a passing touchdown and Matthew Stafford has three of them. But Jalen Hurts also has three touchdowns. He just ran them in himself.
Wake up weekday mornings with Unsportsmanlike with Evan Cohen, Chris Canty, and Michelle Small on 97.3 ESPN. Rack and Fin Radio with Tom P. on 97.3 ESPN.
Hey, hey, back inside Rack and Fin Radio with me, Tom P. We got a September 20th and 21st already. Man, Halloween month is almost here. A great day in history coming up early next week. I don't want to say which one or why, but it was a great day in history. Hey, remember last week we had a Marty Christensen from the New Jersey Waterfowlers on? Now, listen, they're going to be exhibiting next week at the 43rd annual Old Time Barnegat Bay Decoy and Gunning Show up there at Tip Seaman Park on Route 9. Listen, parking's always a problem there. Not a problem, but there's around, but they also have shuttle buses and all other good stuff going. It's a great show. Decoy, carving, calling, dog work, shoot, the whole bit. Marty had mentioned that the work of the waterfowlers, they build a lot of wood duck boxes. And he said to me, he says, Tom P, we have great guys there. We get them. We have them spread all over. But the thing is, wood duck boxes especially have to be maintained. He said, because that's, you know, it's great to get them going up. And they'll have, you know, the first year, they'll have a great nesting success, usually. And then, you know, it's a lot of work involved with that. I put in a call to Joey Lissa. He's been a guest on Rack and Fin Radio several times. He's doing one of the co-founders of Millstone River Preserve up there. I guess that's on the Middlesex, Monmouth border. That organization has, in probably going on 5 years, has tagged close to 500,000 wood ducks. And they put up wood duck boxes. I talked to Joey. He says, Tommy P, the thing, you have to maintain the wood duck boxes because of various reasons we're going to go into now. I found it fascinating. We had a chance, my lovely Dee Marie, turkey hunting with Joey a year before last. And he has wood duck boxes in certain areas of the property. Has cameras in. We're watching a hen on the nest. How freaking cool was that? I mean, my God. Joey, listen, we still talk about that. How you doing, man?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me.
Oh, anytime. Joe, remember that you had the camera set up in here? We're looking at it on your phone. That was wild.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Now, did she successfully nest in the way they went?
Oh, yeah. In about, you know, once they hatched, usually the next day, within 24 hours of them hatching, she'll come out, she'll call the babies out, and they'll just climb right up. And it's amazing how they could jump and stick to that wall of that wood duck box.
Yeah.
And just jump right out like little spiders.
Yeah, Joe, I remember the first time I saw that. I'll never forget it. It was 1981. I was living up in Union County at the time. It was a local lake that was stocked with trout, trout and carp places. Even though it was right there in suburban highway traffic, you could hear it, had a good population of wood ducks. I remember hearing that, eek, eek, eek. What's that? I never, eek, eek, eek. And I looked to my right, Joe, and you saw them coming out of the hole in the tree. These little things, they weren't much like the size of maybe the ladle on a spoon, you know, they swam away with their mom right along the bank, probably a dozen of them. That was so cool to see right there in that suburban / urban environment.
Yep. Next time you see a hollow tree like that, what you should do is just get a little aluminum flashing and just make like a predator guard around the base of that tree.
Good idea.
And no raccoons will ever go in there and kill her, eat the eggs. So we do that all along the Millstone River. You know, all the hollow trees, I put flashing around them. Just a little extra, you know, nesting success for, like, the ducks that are naturally nesting in tree cavities.
Joe, I also understand, don't buffleheads, aren't they tree nesters as well?
Yeah, but they're up in the...
Buffleheads. And also hooded mergansers, I hear.
Yep.
And that's something.
But they're only, like, in upstate New York up. So.
I'm just saying you always associate them with salt marshes and open, you know, open salt water. Well, Joe, before we get into the importance of the wood duck nest maintenance and stuff, what got you into this?
We had all those wetlands that my buddy has. It's 300 continuous acres. He turned it to a non-for-profit. And, I mean, we always enjoyed waterfowl hunting. And we just started putting wood duck boxes. And the success rate was unbelievable. Every box we put up, they had nest boxes. You know, wow. They've had fledglings, every single one. And it just, we're getting more and more ducks coming back every fall during, hunting season.
That's great.
And we're like, well, the more boxes we put, the more ducks we're producing. So now we have 66 wood duck boxes out there. We don't even hunt during the first split of the season. So most of the ducks got bands. That's why we don't want to hunt.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, shoot your nieces and nephews. Well, Joey, I always associate, again, my years of there, wood duck hunting with, and still do, because we'll do the north zones, south and, coastal, not so much the coastal, early in the part of the winter season, the thing I was associated wood ducks up north, like the mountains, the mountain creeks, the acorns, and all the south zone has some of the best wood duck hunting on earth.
Probably thanks to us.
Yeah, I mean, my God. We're in blank county. And the guy says, you put this on the radio, you're dead meat, man. Well, Joe, let's get into the importance. We're up against a break already. I can't believe this. Joe, the importance of the wood duck box maintenance, like you said, the sour rays. Go into that.
Yeah, see, most guys, they just every winter clean out the boxes. They'll install a box, they'll forget about it. But if you want to maximize as many ducklings as you can out of that box, you should clean that box 3 times a year.
Three? Wow.
3 times. Yeah, you do it in the middle of winter, December, January. A lot of the hens, they start nesting, like the older ones, they start nesting early, like the end of February, beginning of April.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sorry, beginning of March. Now, like most of the hens, they start laying eggs in April. Peak hatching is around Mother's Day, around mid-May. But those early ones, when they successfully hatch, they're going to re-nest, and they will make another brood.
They'll nest a second time?
A second time. A wood duck is the only duck that will re-nest twice a year.
Yep. Wow!
So she'll hatch her brood probably around, about April, and then she'll re-nest and probably around June, and she'll hatch a second brood in July. So a lot of times we band these ducks, we could see, like, some of these ducklings are tiny, and the mom, they're usually bigger than most average female wood ducks, but you can see they don't grow flight feathers. I guess, like, the stress of her doing 2 broods in 1 year, you'll see she'll just have quill feathers on her wings.
So
that's a hen that nested. That's her second brood. So,
well, Joe, the stuff that's in the box, cleaning it out, I mean, are there unsuccessful nests where, like, the eggs are in there and they don't hatch? What's the deal with that?
Yeah, that's another reason why it's important to maintain them. A lot of factors. I mean, there's nests where that hen, she goes off the feed, she gets killed by a snapping turtle or something. So now that clutch is, in that box, covered with down, and she'll never return to it. Now, another duck that's going to want to lay her eggs in there is not going to use that box because it's full of eggs already.
There you go.
We have dump boxes. That's another thing. When all the hens come back in April, they're all the first hens are going to take the best boxes. Now you have, let's say you have 50 nest boxes, but there's 75 hens. Either they're going to migrate to find another boxes, which you really want them to do, or what they're going to do is a bunch of them are going to use a community box. It's called a dump box. So you'll find 40, 50 eggs in it.
And what
they're doing is?
Are you kidding? I never heard of such a thing. Are you serious, Glistener?
Yep, dump box.
Wow. Yep.
So what they do is they lay eggs in there, and they're waiting for one of those other nest boxes to hatch out, and then they're gonna jump right in there, and they'll start laying their own eggs in there. So that's why it's important. Like when you're checking out these boxes, what I do is every Memorial Day weekend, that's when I go out there and I start cleaning out the boxes. Memorial Day weekend, about 90% of them will be hatched out by Memorial Day weekend.
Right.
And then they'll start, the ones that had the nest boxes, the dump boxes, they're going to move right in there and start laying eggs. And all the nest boxes will be clean again.
Then
I'll start going out and I'll check them again for the July weekend. And I'll start cleaning out all those eggs that, that hatched out. And I'll just put fresh shavings. So normally, almost every box I put out, we get 2 nests per wood duck box. couple times we'll get three in one box. But most of them, almost everyone, has two clutches per year. Now, if I only put that wood duck box out, cleaned it in February, every February, I would see all the eggshells in there and be like, oh, yeah, it was successful. But a lot of times there's two broods that came out of that box in one season. So, but if you have rotten eggs in there, it's no good. She doesn't want it. There's rotten eggs in there.
And there you go.
You know, for if there's like a dead clutch in there, let's say she got killed and she has a whole clutch of eggs in there.
Right.
You know, that box is going to be sitting there not producing any ducks.
Yeah, join us online this morning is Joey Lista, co-founder of Millstone River Preserve. These guys have wood duck box maintenance, very important. You want to maximize if you're putting up wood duck boxes and you know, be part of you know the conservation effort. Takes maintenance to make them to maximize on the success. And Joey, like you said, like I said earlier, banded half a thousand. They gave 500 wood ducks in fifth year of the organization. That's an amazing number, bro.
Yep, and also when you have to clean out these boxes, you got to make sure that you put like the shavings in there, at least a quarter to a third full on these nest boxes.
There you go.
A lot of guys, they just put a little handful in there. She wants to bury her eggs. When she lays her eggs, she covers them up. Every day she lays one egg a day until she gets about 13 to 16, and then she'll incubate them. But if those eggs are exposed, those red-bellied woodpeckers, they'll go in there and they'll peck every single egg. They'll kill every egg. So, and you know, there's also like, you got vines climbing up, make sure there's no vines or saplings because, you know, raccoons will use that as a bridge to get to the nest box.
Nest
any
breeders,
low
man.
Overhanging branches, you want to make sure you cut them free, get them away from the box. And predator guards, very important. You put up a predator guard in every wood duck box. In the beginning, I was cutting corners. You know, we had nest boxes out in the middle of the swamp, you know, waist deep water. I'm thinking no raccoon, nothing's going to go out there, swim out there and climb up this pole. So I would see like, there'd be like maybe three or four eggs in there. I go back a couple weeks later to check up on it and those eggs would be gone. And I'm thinking like, what the hell is eating these eggs? Not leaving eggshells or anything. Then we put a predator guard and the eggs started, you know, we started getting more and more eggs in there and then the hen would sit. The problem was water snakes. They're swimming out there and they're climbing. Yep, they climb right up that pole. It's like a long-legged go-go dancer. They go right up to that pole. They go right inside that box, and they suck down the whole egg. And they'll take an egg a day until it's completely gone.
That description was vintage list of people.
Vintage.
Joe, we're up against the break. Listen, you take care. Hope to see you sometime this fall, man. Let's get together.
You got it.
Take care, man. Be good.
You got
hey,
it.
Hey, listen, Joe, information on the Millstone River Preserve.
Information on it?
Yeah, how do people find out? You have a Facebook or what?
All right, yes. I have a YouTube channel.
Okay.
Called Waterfowl Production, spelled P-R-O, capital D-U-C-K-T-I-O-N. I have 55 videos on propagating waterfowl, especially wood ducks. So find it and subscribe to it. There's 55 videos. Snapping turtle trapping, that's key. If you want a lot of ducklings, you need to trap snapping turtles. A lot of people don't know that. But
there you go,
see
man.
That mother duck, if she's got two, three ducklings left,
there you go, man. That's what they want. Okay, Joey, you take care, brother. Be good.
All right, thank you.
See you. Joey, listen, man. So what an organization. The operation is amazing. Be right back. Rockin' Fin Radio.
This Saturday night, the fourth-ranked Miami Hurricanes clash with the Florida Gators in a fierce Sunshine State showdown. Live from Hard Rock Stadium, kickoff is at 7:30 Eastern. Catch every moment on Touchdown Radio with play-by-play from J.P. Shadrick and analysis from the 1992 Heisman Trophy winner Gino Toretta. Don't miss the fourth-ranked Miami Hurricanes versus the Florida Gators only on this Touchdown Radio station.
It's College Football Saturday on 97.3 ESPN.
Rack and Fin Radio with Tom P on 97.3 ESPN.
Hey, welcome back to Rack and Fin Radio with me, Tom P. Weekend of September 20th and 21st. Hope everyone is enjoying the early bow season. Those 29 DMZs, just be aware of the antler point restriction. Those DMZ zones, go to page 34, 35 in the digest. You'll see all the information there. But especially now in a thick cover, it's warm. You want to recover deer as soon as possible. Okay, here's the thing. Sometimes blood trails are there. Sometimes blood trails aren't. You don't want to lose the animal. The blood trackers, a lot of from understand it's not blood. The organization with using dogs to help recover deer and also bear is growing in popularity. There's a need for it. It's necessary to have that option, especially now when you got this really thick cover going on in some areas down south, like Northern Cape May County, Beaver Swamp. Mary, Mother of God. It's just a crazy time. Join us on the line right now from Pine Barrens Deer Recovery, Jimmy Miranda, who has his coolest of all bloodhounds. Name is Roscoe. He's been doing this now for a few years, and we want to get out about the tracking, the deer tracking, what's involved with it. I want to get into the training of Roscoe as well, and then how to get in touch and get that deer if you can, especially, I don't care how experienced you are. Sometimes, man, no blood, little bit of blood, the help of a dog is make or break. Hey, doing, Jimmy, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you doing this morning, sir?
I'm just getting a little too, because you know what happened the other night? Some guys says, hey, look, if you need a dog, trap the deer, blah, blah, blah. I never lost a deer. I've been hunting 40 years. I can't believe still people think like that, but that's all right. That's good. And I just said, you have an opportunity to find a deer that you took the responsibility of shooting. And, well, you know, if it's a, you're not a true hunter unless, you find it yourself. I don't know, Miranda. Have you run into that at all?
I tell you what, I have run into it quite a few times and proved a couple doubters the other way. You can't win them all, but I would definitely say malarkey would be the word I would use. Rather give that animal an opportunity to be recovered, especially like you had just previously mentioned. Once we get into like this, that thick areas, or right now, this time of year, with the heat is a factor. We want to get on this animal as quick as possible, so that way we could salvage all of the meat and whatnot.
Okay, Jimmy, one thing. Let's clear. They call it blood trackers, but I understand it's not blood or the actual tracking itself. For example, with Roscoe, what's he smelling? Again, you have deer tracks all over. Differentiating, what is the scent that he's following?
Right. So with all of us from the United Blood Trackers Association, we utilize off of the interdigital gland. It's a gland in between the hoof of the deer, and it secretes like a creamy substance. Now, what happens is when that deer is fatally hit, it starts to secrete, and as that deer runs off, it's leaving its mark. And as far as well as while it's running through brush, it's secreting different scents all over the bush, the brush, and the dogs are able to track that. Now, for the non-fatal deer, if you were to hit it, sometimes you hear guys talk about, well, the dog was on it for about 100 yards and then kind of just stopped. And what that's usually an indicator of is that it was a non-fatal hit and that gland has stopped producing the, I almost want to call it the fatal scent. And it's one of the quickest indicators that we get. And blood is nice for you and I. It's nice for the hunter just to say, "Yep, here's blood."
Yeah.
But blood is the last thing that's needed for us anyway.
I find that fascinating. And there's an array of canines that are used now. Roscoe's a bloodhound. I've seen labs. I've seen it. Training the dog for that. I mean, was Roscoe a bloodhound? Actually, we're getting blood, but how did you train him for this?
Well, I had a successor. His name is Patrick Lynn. He's another tracker as well in New Jersey, and he really set me up for success from the beginning. He got me into a lot of the educational points behind it. He showed me how to set up the proper stuff that I'm going to need to use, and a lot of practice. It was a lot of work. I would say it took Roscoe probably a good solid 8 months to really. And I take that back, Tom, because you know what? There's still situations that we learn today. There's still things that I learn from him every day. But it takes a little while. It takes a little training, depending on the breed of dog as well. Like you had said, I personally went with the bloodhound just because of the background, because of their nose, the ability to smell much longer and to hold a track for a much longer period of time.
I remember Casey Mack. I think he's a blue heeler. No, Casey Mack.
What an awesome guy. And that dog, what an awesome dog. Talk about legendary. Uh-huh. He's been doing it since I was a kid. I the first name that comes to my mind, him and Mr. Darren Doran, you know, two legendary individuals.
Join us on the line is Jimmy Miranda, Pine Barrens Deer Recovery. Listeners, especially now, early in the season, it's warm. We're going to have hunting days, 70s, lower 80s. Important to get to that deer. Yeah, if a fatal hit, even a marginal hit, it's a make-or-break game. With if you have the opportunity to have the services of a trained canine for this. Now, Jimmy, is Roscoe has to be leashed, correct?
Yes, sir. So in the state of New Jersey, they're mandatory to be leashed. We put them on leads that are not allowed to be in excess of 30 feet.
That's what I was, yeah. By leashed, I meant leasing. But, man, in some of that cover, now that Bull Briars, I mean, he's come out of there looking like he went through a meat grinder.
Oh, absolutely. I get more pats on the back from hunters when they tell me, he went where? I'll meet you on the other side. You know, I tell you, Tom, when we had an opportunity and a very successful outing last year doing bear, and I am not from North Jersey, so I was not prepared for. I'm physically in shape for the mountains, but I was not prepared for these red briar patches. I was on my hands and knees crawling, and I mean, I had the dog look back a couple times, just wondering what in the heck are we doing.
There's some thick stuff up there as well. How the bears get through it? How the bears get through stuff like that quietly is what still blows my mind.
Well, I have not the fondest clue.
Yeah, Jimmy, let me ask you. We're up against a heartbreak. Couple of minutes. Your toughest, Roscoe's toughest track successful, how long and whereabouts was it?
My longest successful track was probably 32 hours last season. I'm not quite sure. I think it was a 13 or 14 pointer, a gentleman's shot. We got on it the night. We got on it in the evening. I worked it. The deer got up, took off. Roscoe knew it. We came back the next day. We started on it again. The deer up and gone for a second time. We waited to the evening the following day, and we were able to complete it. So I was around 32 hours old after by the time it was shot and we got to it. My longest was actually a bear in North Jersey that had gone so off of my Garmin GPS, it had gone about 3.2 miles.
Where were you, up in the Water Gap or Stokes or somewhere? Way beyond it? Where were you?
I was actually right above Stokes.
Yeah. Okay, I know the area well. Yeah.
I was right above Stokes, and I got to tell you, that was just remarkable. It was bare minimal blood. I mean, we were just, you know, there's times that even I don't like to do it, but even I question. I'm like, are we going the right way? And every time that we needed an answer, there it would be in a pin drop of blood.
Hey, dude, don't do the Moses tapping the rock twice. You know what happened with that, don't you?
No,
going back to my Catholic school days. Well, listen, yeah, so with the bear now, was it pretty much a blood thing? He wasn't trained on that interdigital scent, right? So how did he get onto the bears?
Yes, sir. You know what? We run them the same way. Now, I utilize some bear parts. I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Okay.
For the tracking practicing purposes.
All right.
But, you know, with the bear, I'm a little more vigilant. I personally believe that just the smell that come off of them, you know, and once once I speak for Roscoe, once he locks onto that trail, I actually found that to be easier than the whitetail, to be very truthful with you.
There you go. There you go. Well, Jimmy, thanks for joining us on Rack and Fin Radio. Pine Barrens Deer Recovery. Jimmy, people want to find out more. You have a Facebook page or website. Go, bro.
Absolutely. You can visit myself and Roscoe at Pine Barrens Deer Tracking and Recovery, and we ask that you reach out to us directly. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, reach out to us. Even if you just want some friendly advice, we are more than accommodating to everybody. We do this. We try to get to as many hunters as we possibly can, and we wish everybody a safe and blessed hunting season this year.
Jimmy, question, it comes down to this. Is there a fee? Is it a donation? Is it a tip? What's the dealio? You're doing this gratis? What's up with that?
You know what, sir? I just do it off of a donation base. If I'm driving, I've had trips where I've gone 3 hours, you know, and people giving me donations. That's awfully nice of them. It just basically just covers the fuel, to be very truthful with you. And I feel like all the trackers are pretty much the same way. For children, you know, I use myself for youth hunts. We usually do them for free. If it's local to the area, I do my best just to get out there. I enjoy the outdoors just as much as the next person. This is just an extension of hunting for me, so it's therapeutical.
There you go. Okay, one more time with a Facebook or website, please.
Yes, sir. So you can visit us at Pine Barrens Deer Tracking and Recovery.
Deer Tracking and Recovery. I left out the tracking deer. You should have told me about that, Jimmy.
Yeah, I got to shorten it up.
You take care, man. Travel safe. How's Mason doing, man?
We are enjoying, you know, we didn't get out this week, opening weekend. I do apologize to all of our New Jersey hunters. The wife put her foot down, so we're in Disney World, so we're experiencing that, and we're absolutely having a ball out here. But we'll be back in town this weekend, and okay, we'll be back at it again to serve all of our fellow hunters in New Jersey.
Okay, look forward to meeting you, Jimmy. You take care. Best of the family.
All right, Mr. Tom. Have a great day.
See you, brother. Fascinating guy. Yeah, the tracking. This one guy I couldn't understand. Well, that's fine. That's like, well, unless you crossbows are no good. If you're a real go, you got to go. You got to practice. Wait, so using a crossbow, you become proficient a lot quicker. What's wrong with that? Same thing with this. If you have the opportunity, and I just say, I lost one deer once, and it's just a horrible, horrible, horrible feeling. Not that I get that many deer, I don't, but you lose. And so if you have back then, way back then, This service wasn't available. It took a bunch of years for it to finally get, you know, finalized in there. But if you need it, use it. Don't let, and this, again, the social media stuff, the responsibility is to the game animal. Okay, be right back. Wrapping it up. Rockin' Fin Radio.
Eagles football on 97.3 ESPN. It's an NFC divisional round rematch in week 3 as the Eagles host the LA Rams.
Back to Stafford. He looks up. He has the ball knocked out of his hands. Eagles have it.
Yep.
And Zach Bourne recovers.
Pre-game coverage begins at noon. Merrill and Mike call all the action starting at 1 p.m. This is where the Eagles play. 97.3 ESPN. South Jersey's official Eagles station. Rack and Fin Radio with Tom P. on 97.3 ESPN.
Hey, before we go, congratulations. Jack Cittarelli getting the endorsement of New Jersey Outdoor Alliance. Remember, this election coming up is about fishing, hunting, and the shooting sports. Go, Jack, on that one. Another reminder, too, how the great Noel Feliciano with the great one-stop bait and tackle there, 416 Atlantic Avenue, is having his Casting for a Cure tournament today. Started at 6, goes till 6 p.m. this evening. No entry fee. There's going to be loads of cash prizes, a lot of giveaways. It's going to be for a great cause, Fluke, Tog, and Stripers. Give Noel a call at 609-348-9450 for more information. Easy to get to. The way the bite is going on, man, you're going to get something. God bless America. God bless our troops. God bless our first responders and law enforcement. Get out there and enjoy. See you next Saturday, Rack and Fin Radio.